On behalf of the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia, CRECA, I'm very glad to welcome you to our Thursday lecture series. My name is Jennifer Tischler, and I'm the Associate Director of CRECA. And we have a smaller, but I sense very devoted group in attendance today. If you're new to our lecture series, feel free to pick up a schedule from the back of the room, and we also have a sign-up sheet if you'd like to join our mailing list of lectures and other events. And I did want to make a special note. This will be the last lecture before spring break, so we won't be meeting next Thursday. But then when we come back in the month of April, we have several talks having to do with Polish literature, Central European history and politics more generally, April 12th, translating Polish literature into English, a history by Michael Mikosz, also from UW-Milwaukee. The 19th of the month, Tom Inglatt from Minnesota State University, Mankato, will be speaking on building welfare states for the young, politics of family policy in Hungary, Poland, and Romania. And then on the 26th of April, Greg Czarnecki, who works as the national coordinator of Equal Youth, I'm not sure of the pronunciation, but an LGBT equality organization in Poland, will be giving a talk. Stranger Things Have Happened, The Road Towards LGBT Equality in Poland. So we have a wealth of interesting talks coming up on Central Europe, thanks in a large part to the person who will be introducing today's speaker, Professor David Danaher of the Slavic Department.
Good segue, Jennifer.
Yeah.
Actually, thanks to CRECA for funding our course on Central Eastern European Production Center. And our speaker today is Neil Pease from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He's a professor of history there. And we actually already had him give a wonderful talk on the history of the Catholic Church and its role in dissent in our course today. So we're asking him to do double duty. Professor Pease has taught at UW-Milwaukee since 1983. His primary research and teaching interests are the history of Poland and Central Europe and also the Catholic Church. As a side note, he also teaches a course on baseball, American
history.
If there are questions about baseball and American history or Bud Selig, you can ask Professor Pease. So a wide range of interests. His most recent book, which was published by Ohio University Press in 2009, is called Rome's Most Faithful Daughter, the Catholic Church in Independent Poland, 1914 to 1939. And this book won several awards, one from the Association for Slavic, East Europe, and Eurasian Studies, or ACES, if we're in the field, we know that, and also one from the American Catholic Historical Association for the best book in the field of Catholic history. And the subject of his talk today will be from that book.
Yes, it is.
Yes. I'll give the floor to Professor Pease.
Thank you. Well, thank you for coming. I know that there are any number of options that people can have to entertain themselves on an early spring day, sunny early spring day in Madison, and I hope I can make the next hour or so worthwhile enough that you won't regret your choice. As David said, you've been getting and will get a fair amount of representation from UW-Milwaukee. I understand that my new colleague, who teaches Russian history for us, Christine Evans.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't here for the talk, but I've seen a version of that talk before on Soviet television. She's a new hire for us. She's teaching Russian history for us for the first time, and she's doing wonderful, wonderful work. And I trust that any of you who saw that will remember that. And I'll just have to try to live up to Christine's standards. The Wawel incident of 1937. Polish, of course, Wawel. That's this word here. W in Polish has the sound of V. And the Wawel is both a hill in the city of Krakow, in southern Poland. And it's also the name that is given to the historic buildings that are situated on the crest of Wawel Hill, the royal castle, and the Catholic cathedral in this very Catholic country, known as, familiarly though not officially, as the Wawel Cathedral. Now, where to start? The Wawel incident of 1937, church, state, and nation in interwar Poland. And I'll give you a little word of warning. I'm going to be talking about one particular relatively obscure incident. It says incident right there, right? That happened about 75 years ago. And what I'm going to suggest is that that incident, though small, and in some ways almost laughably trivial, can tell us certain important things about the role that Catholicism played in Poland in the years before World War II. And in so doing, I'm hoping that I can suggest that Catholicism in Poland is a phenomenon that is a little more complicated than most people would think. Poland is often thought of as among the most monolithically Catholic countries in the world. To a certain extent, this is true. Nowadays, about 90% of the population of Poland would identify itself as Catholic. A majority of that 90% would attend Mass on a weekly basis. I'm repeating, and any of you who are at my earlier talk will recognize that I'm just sort of reworking themes that I used in that talk as well. These are figures that would place Poland among the most solidly Catholic countries in the world today, along with Lithuania, maybe the Philippines, something like that. And of course, it's widely known that Catholicism has been an extraordinarily important force in recent Polish history. And I'm not talking about the Poland of today. I'm talking about the Poland of three quarters of a century ago. And in some ways, that was a different Poland. And the role that Catholicism played in Poland in the 1920s and 1930s was different, in some ways more complicated than the role it played after World War II and in the days of the Cold War. Now, to begin, some of you may recall that in April 2010, you may have seen scenes something like this. Some of you may recall that in April of 2010, an airplane bearing an official delegation from Poland, including the president of Poland, Lech Kaczynski, his wife, Maria, and almost 100 other Polish officials, dignitaries, who were traveling to Russia to observe the anniversary of the so-called Katyn Forest Massacre of World War II, the mass killing of some 22,000 Polish prisoners of war by the Soviet NKVD. Well, that plane crashed near Smolensk, and this set off these scenes of national mourning. You see the funeral procession of President Kaczynski in April 2010. President Kaczynski was buried in the Cathedral Church of the city of Kraków, officially known as the Cathedral of Saints Stanisław, Stanislaus, and Vaclav, but more familiarly known as the Wawel Cathedral because of its location on Wawel Hill. The decision, Wawel is the site of the Polish Pantheon. That is the traditional site, the burial place for the luminaries of Polish political and intellectual and cultural life. Kings, poets, artists, writers. It is, in a sense, sort of the Polish equivalent of Westminster Abbey or something like that. The decision was made that President Kaczynski would be buried in Wawel Cathedral. And there you see his tomb. housing, the bodies of both President Kaczynski and his wife. The decision for the interment of the Kaczynskis in the Wawel Cathedral was a controversial one in Poland at the time. Some of you might be Polish speakers. If not, this is a headline from a newspaper at the time. Who allowed Lech and Maria Kaczynski into the Wawel? And what this goes on to say, the first paragraph of this newspaper story, is to explain that this was the decision of the Archbishop of Kraków, Cardinal Dziwisz, who, as the Archbishop of Wawel Cathedral, was also the caretaker of the Wawel graves. And it was Dziwisz who decided to permit the burial of President Kaczynski. Now, many Poles approved of this decision, but many did not. There were protests at the time outside of the Wawel. Here's a gathering, and you see a banner here saying, "Was he really on? Is he really worthy to sleep with the kings?" You know. Now, these scenes from 2010 reminded me of something that I had come upon in my researches. A similar state funeral in Kraków, shown here, but one 70-some years earlier, in 1937. An interment in the Wawel that led to public protests, such as you see here. But this didn't involve President Lech Kaczynski. It involved the man who was arguably the single most important figure in Polish political life in the first half of the 20th century, Marshal Józef Piłsudski. Piłsudski, probably many of you know the basic outlines of the biography of Marshal Piłsudski. Back in the days before World War I, when there was no Poland, when the Polish lands were still under foreign rule, Piłsudski had led a movement to try to recover Polish independence. He was given main credit by Poles for the recovery of Polish independence during and immediately after the First World War. He served as the chief of state and the commander of the Polish armies in the early days of independence of interwar Poland, the so-called Second Polish Republic. Then, after a brief retirement from public life, he staged a coup d'etat, seized political power, and ruled as something of an informal benevolent dictator, if you will, or strongman rule from 1926 until his death in 1935. And it was the death and burial of Marshal Piłsudski and the controversy over his resting place within the Wawel Cathedral that formed the Wawel Incident, as it came to be called, of 1937. And what I'm going to do is to walk you through the background of this, the Wawel Incident itself in 1937, the storm of controversy that arose in Poland, explain how it was all sort of settled and rather quickly forgotten, but then at the end try to summarize what we can learn from this intriguing incident about exactly the role that Catholicism played in Poland back in those days. Any questions so far? All right. Now, I've already apologized to a couple of things. I've already apologized in an earlier lecture for my habitual laziness by which I don't write out lectures. You know, can't be bothered, right? So what I do, my MO, is that I show the pictures and I just talk my way through them. So if you will please train your eyes on the pictures, not on me, and just, you know, hope that I'm in good form today so that I don't go off the rails. If at some point I wander or whatever, just look more bored than usual, I might get the message. Now, one thing I will mention, and this comes in the sort of shameless self-promotion, this is an incident that forms part of my book that David kindly referred to, Rome's Most Faithful Daughter, the Catholic Church in Independent Poland, 1914 to 1939, which is a study of the role that Catholicism played in Poland and that Poland played in the larger Catholic world between the two world wars, 1914 to 1939. And actually, you know, if you listen to the talk and listen to it, you might not have to buy the book, because this actually forms the brunt of chapter 8. At least you won't have to read chapter 8. And I've had at least two people tell me, you know, that was my favorite part of the book. That was the one part of the book that was fun. Okay. And sales of academic books being as they are, you know, two might actually form the bulk of my readership. So this may be close to a consensus. But anyway, Marshall Piłsudski. We see here a photograph of a couple of luminaries. And this is taken in 1919, and it's a picture of a Catholic mass that was held in the broad square in Warsaw that in those days was known as Saxon Square. It was later known, among other, you know, later it became Adolf Hitler Platz during the German occupation of World War II. It became Victory Square during the communist days. And now it is known as Piłsudski Square, named after this gentleman here, the aforementioned Józef Piłsudski, who was serving at that time as, quote-unquote, chief of state and commander of the armed forces of Poland. There are a couple other people that you might recognize. Anybody make out who that is? Is that a familiar face? Herbert Hoover, the future president of the United States, who at that point was representative of the American Relief Administration, doing charitable work in post-war Poland. The gentleman standing here is the famous pianist Ignacy Jan Paderewski, who at that time was serving as the prime minister of the new Polish government. And this, seated in the middle, is the papal nuncio to the new Poland, Archbishop Achille Ratti. Now, the nuncio, some of you may know that in Vatican speak, a nuncio is the equivalent of an ambassador. So, Ratti was the ambassador of the Holy See, of the Vatican, to Catholic Poland. Now, we have some interesting dynamics here. Polish politics was a complicated game in those days. Nowadays, when we think of Poland, we think of a country that is 100% ethnically Polish and almost 100% Catholic in its religious affiliation. This was a Poland that was only two-thirds ethnically Polish and two-thirds religiously Catholic. Poles themselves were divided sharply politically. For simplifying purposes, we could say that there were the followers of Piłsudski, representing roughly the center and moderate left. Their opponents, the parties of the right, generally known as the National Democrats. The National Democrats put themselves forward as the main representatives of defenders of Catholic interests in Poland. On the other hand, Piłsudski himself, well, he was nominally Catholic, but a very lax and unorthodox Catholic. He represented a largely anti-clerical political movement, and his inner circle of followers who supported him throughout his political life were notorious as a hotbed of irreligion, Freemasonry, anti-clerical, essentially. So to most Poles, whether you like Piłsudski or not, and he was both the most... Sorry about that. He was both the most admired but the most controversial man in Poland. He was not regarded as a defender of the Catholic Church. Now, on the other hand, it's complicated. I don't want to go into it. If you want to ask me in question form, I can go into it. You would think that the Vatican would have supported the National Democrats, right? No, you can see where I'm going with this. They didn't. The Vatican actually much preferred Piłsudski. And in particular, Archbishop Ratti, the papal nuncio, took a personal as well as political liking to Piłsudski. And he was nuncio in Poland between 1918 and 1921. And he and Piłsudski formed a strong friendship that lasted throughout the remainder of both men's lives. He preferred Piłsudski to his rivals, both on personal and political grounds. There was also another factor. Ratti was nuncio in Poland at the time of the Polish-Soviet War of 1919-1920. Some of you may know that in August of 1920, the forces of the Red Army seemed to be on the verge of defeating Poland and spreading communism westward into war-torn Europe. It was Piłsudski, leading Polish forces, who won what appeared to be a miraculous victory over the Bolsheviks, literally at the gates of Warsaw. And Ratti never forgot this. He regarded Piłsudski as a genuine hero of Christian civilization. So it's important to remember that Piłsudski and Ratti had formed this close connection. And this becomes important later on because in 1921, Ratti is actually sort of hounded out of Poland. Again, the background is complicated. By the National Democrats and the Polish bishops who supported the National Democrats. This was a bad move on their part because of what happened in the Vatican in early 1922. Ratti returned to Italy, became the Archbishop and Cardinal of Milan, and then in February 1922 was elected Pope. And he led the Catholic Church as Pope Pius XI, not the more famous later Pius XII, but Pius XI. And you see that his pontificate lasted from 1922 until 1939, practically the eve of the Second World War. During the lengthy pontificate of Pius XI, Piłsudski became the de facto dictator of Poland for most of that time, from the mid-1920s until his death in 1935. And during that time, Pius XI had a high regard for Piłsudski, and that was reciprocated. And this was important because followers of Piłsudski. Okay. Have I lost you yet? Are we still okay? Okay. Now here's the deal. The dominant political force in Poland is this anti-clerical party that is aligned with Piłsudski. But their leader, Piłsudski himself, does not subscribe to this. He doesn't persecute the church. He wants to be on good terms with the church. And the thing that keeps the relationship between the Vatican and Poland on an even keel is precisely this friendship between Pius XI and Piłsudski. They trust each other. And Pius XI knows that he can trust Piłsudski to be reasonable in dealing with a Catholic church in Poland that largely despises Piłsudski. And vice versa. Piłsudski realizes that he can rely on Pius XI to use his influence to try to persuade Polish bishops not to be too overt in opposing the Piłsudski government. It was this very delicate sort of arrangement that they were following. Okay, now you're probably beginning to wonder, when is he actually going to start talking about the Wawelins? I mean, we've been going on and on and on and on and on about this, but we're getting there. Okay. Now, the Archbishop of Krakow at the time was this man, Prince Adam Stefan Sapieha. He was the bearer of one of the most illustrious names of the Polish nobility. He was a man of uncommon ability. He was Archbishop of Krakow from 1912 until 1951. In other words, he was the leader of Catholic Krakow during both World Wars. Some of you may know that he was the de facto leader of the Polish Church in occupation during World War II, and that he took under his wing during World War II a promising young seminarian named Karol Wojtyła, who later became better known by his professional name of John Paul II. During these days, Sapieha was one of the best known clerical supporters of national democracy, of the National Democrats. And he was well known as a political opponent of Marshal Piłsudski. He was also the caretaker of the Wawel graves. Okay? Got all that together? Now, in 1933, by this time, Marshal Piłsudski, visibly aging and infirm, visited the Wawel Cathedral and, accompanied by Archbishop Sapieha, made plain his desire that upon his demise, he would wish to be buried in the crypts of the Wawel Cathedral. Sapieha didn't like this. He thought he had a deal with the government. He thought he had a personal deal with Piłsudski. In the later 1920s, Piłsudski had... The Wawel graves were considered closed. Okay? Nobody else was to be buried there. But Piłsudski made a personal plea to Sapieha to allow the reinterment of a famous Polish poet from the 19th century, who was a particular favorite of Piłsudski's. So, Sapieha complied. And as far as he's concerned, he's the guy still in charge of Wawel Cathedral. It's his responsibility. But Piłsudski says, look, you know, I want to be buried in Wawel too. Sapieha didn't like this, but he was agreed. He didn't much care for Piłsudski personally, but he was mindful of the special role that he had played in Polish history. And, well, you know, I would have preferred if the crypts would have remained closed, but we'll make an exception in this case. The moment came in May of 1935. Piłsudski died, was given a fulsome state funeral with all sorts of ceremony and the like. You see here his coffin being borne on a caisson, And this is the moment prior to his interment in the Vaudeville Cathedral. And, well, there you see, that was a picture that I showed earlier. And he was, his remains were placed in the main crypt in the bowels of the Vaudeville, in the basement or the dungeon of the Vaudeville, St. Leonard's Crypt. Okay. Now, one would think that that is the end of the story, but not necessarily. Piłsudski had died in 1935. Now, after Piłsudski's death, sort of the main means that the new government, the government had for justifying its, you know, it was the government of Piłsudski, right? And now Piłsudski was gone. So what were you going to do? Well, you would justify yourself as the legators of Piłsudski. And there developed a sort of cult of personality, of adulation of the dead man. And whereas the regime had depended on Piłsudski living for about 10 years, now it came to depend on Piłsudski dead. And the sort of myth, the patriotic myth of Piłsudski. And the Vaudeville became a place of pilgrimage. And people would come from all around to enter the cathedral and pay respects to the dead man. And of course, this meant that they would queue up to enter the church and go into St. Leonard's crypt to observe, to pay respects at the sarcophagus. Now, this happened every day. And the people who visited Piłsudski's grave did not necessarily do so out of a sense of respect for a holy place. Many of them were not Catholics. They were devotees of Piłsudski, not of the church. Many of them treated it as a kind of festive occasion. You know, and you would have noise, you would have litter, you would have vodka bottles strewn about the cathedral. And it didn't take Archbishop Sapieha long to say, this can't go on. This can't go on. You know, we have to find some way of preserving the quiet and dignity of the centuries-old cathedral. So they worked out a deal. They worked out a deal. You know, the problem was that Piłsudski's sarcophagus was in St. Leonard's crypt. And to get to St. Leonard's crypt, you had to enter the cathedral proper and then go down into the dungeon. Okay, you see here more lines to get in there, and that's the main entrance to the church there. And I probably should have, you know, this is a portrait of Sapieha taken in 1937, 2 years after Piłsudski's death. And at this point, he's starting to get a little impatient. And a deal had been reached already about a year earlier that the government would construct a new crypt beneath the so-called Tower of the Silver Bells. And there a special sarcophagus, a special crypt would be prepared for Piłsudski's sarcophagus, which would be transferred from St. Leonard's crypt to the Tower of the Silver Bells. Now, the beauty of this arrangement was that you could go into the Silver Bells crypt directly without having to go through the church. And this appealed, you know, wonderfully to Sapieha. You know, he just wanted to get the crowds and the clutter and the noise and the litter and the indignity out of the church. So he's waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting for this to happen. Now, he was a man who was not long on patience and had a bit of a temper. And after a while, He came to the conclusion that the government was dragging its feet. It was being altogether, the government, it was a government committee, right? So it worked slowly. And it came up with all these plans for making the crypt extremely ornate. You know, at one point, you know, Satyal is saying, what are you building? Are you building a crypt? Are you building a boudoir? You know, come on. Let's get it done, and let's get the transfer done. By mid-year of 1937, he's had it up to here, and he's actually beginning to think that the government really doesn't want to move the sarcophagus in the first place. And that if anybody is going to get them to move off the dime, he is going to have to take action, because he, after all, is the caretaker of the Vavil graves as far as he's concerned. This is my responsibility. I have to take care of the crypts. I have to take care of the church. Now, another thing happens by mid-year of 1937. A visitor is coming to Poland. The King of Romania, King Carol II. Romania and Poland were allies. King Carol was going to pay a state visit to Poland, and he made plain that he wanted to go to the Wawel Cathedral and pay respects at the sarcophagus of the great man Piłsudski. Now, there were a couple of problems with this. In the first place, does any of you know anything about King Carol? Okay. He was known as the Playboy King. He was famously dissolute. He kept conspicuous company with lovely women, not his wife, and much his junior, and was regularly lampooned in what passed for the gossip pages of those days. So there was that, the fact that he was sort of notoriously dissolute. Then there was the fact that he was not Catholic. He was Romanian. He was Orthodox. Nowadays, that wouldn't make a difference. But in the Catholic world of 1937, the propriety of a schismatic Christian entering a hallowed area of Catholic worship caused problems. Archbishop Sapieha apparently decided that he did not want the interior of his cathedral sullied by the presence of King Carol. And so he made the decision, okay, how can I get out of this? Now, at this point, you have a sort of accident happen, that being that Archbishop Sapieha had a chance conversation with the architect of the Piłsudski crypt, the crypt of the silver bells, the new crypt, who, you know how you end up saying things and you immediately wish you hadn't said them? The architect mentioned to Archbishop Sapieha, you know, the new crypt is just about done. We could move in there tomorrow. Or, you know, words to that effect, right? Now, he wasn't speaking officially. You know, that wasn't his decision. You know, it was the government that was going to say, okay, it's ready, and all of that. But Sapieha heard this and said, okay, well, there is no reason to dilly-dally. So, on his own, without asking or consulting the Polish government, in late May, or is it June? June of 1937, Sapieha announces unilaterally that he has decided to move the sarcophagus of Marshal Piłsudski. Without ceremony, in the middle of the night, just having his sextons do it, and it was going to happen immediately. P- people were aghast. When word of this leaked out, the president of the republic, Ignacy Moshchitsky, personally pleaded with Sapieha not to do that. Sapieha told him that it was his decision, he was the caretaker of the Vavil, he was going to do what he thought he had to do. And just for good, Sapieha was not a man long on tact, let's say. He threw in for good measure the fact that the dampness in St. Leonard's crypt was such that it was corrupting the integrity of Piłsudski's corpse, and so it was necessary to make the transfer for reasons of decorum, as well as anything else. The Vatican was appalled when it heard this. The newly dispatched nuncio to Poland, Archbishop Filippo Cortesi, who had just arrived in Poland a few days ago, also told Sapieha, you better not do this. This is just bad news waiting to happen. Sapieha sort of blew him off, said in effect, look, you've only been in Poland a couple of days. The Vatican needs to mind its own business. You know, I'm in charge of the Vavil. This is my decision. And from his point of view, that was bottom line, you know. He was responsible for maintaining the dignity and decorum of Vavil Cathedral. He decided it was necessary to get rid of the clamor and the clutter and the noise and just the sort of carnival atmosphere. And there's no doubting that was a real factor. So anyway, as I said, the transfer of Piłsudski's sarcophagus to the Silver Bells Cathedral was undertaken under cover of night, June 23rd, 1937, without ceremony and with no prior notice given to the Piłsudski family. Well, Sapieha thought that he had undertaken a simple matter of housekeeping, you know, but he had no idea that the actions that he had done would lead to a violent, if brief, storm of protest and controversy inside Poland. The very next day, the Prime Minister of Poland, Felicjan Sławoj-Składkowski, sort of theatrically announced his intention to resign on the sort of, well, labored grounds that this terrible thing had happened on his watch and he had been unable to prevent it. Cooler heads prevailed, and he did not resign, but the government issued howls of protests that were to some extent orchestrated and to some extent histrionic, but also touched on a genuine sense of outrage. You know, one thing was that the complicated background, the idea that there was this clamor going on in the Vavil Cathedral, that there had been an agreement in principle between Sapieha and the government that new arrangements would have to be made, that it had been planned all along that Piłsudski's body would be moved to the Silver Bells location. People didn't know that. That wasn't really public knowledge. What was apparent to a lot of people was that a Catholic archbishop who was notoriously hostile to Piłsudski in life had seemingly, for no particular reason, banished the bones of the great man from his cathedral. And in doing so, he had touched the regime at precisely its most sensitive spot. This was its holy of holies, you know, the bones of Piłsudski. Not to mention the fact that the government would not admit what Sapieha took as fact, that being that Sapieha and Sapieha alone had the right to decide what was going to happen in the national pantheon. the government claimed a right as well to have a say on this, and the fact that the Archbishop of Krakow had personally refused to honor the request of the President of Poland regarding the procedure of where to place Piłsudski's body when they weren't going to let that pass. And actually what they did was they sort of gave free rein to the followers of Piłsudski to go out in the streets, to protest, to march. The palace of Archbishop Sapieha was pelted with rocks and eggs. Catholic newspapers in Warsaw and Kraków were broken into by rowdies. Parliamentarians, you know, spoke about having Sapieha sacked, about possibly even a rupture of relations between Poland and the papacy, Catholic Poland, you know, breaking with the Holy See. These were the sorts of things that were in the air in late June 1937 as a result of this. You see here a rally in support of the President of Poland, the President of Poland who had begged Sapieha not to move the Piłsudski casket. At this point, both sides, the Vatican and the Polish government, decided it was necessary to reach a solution and to reach one quick. The Vatican was appalled by Sapieha's behavior. But, of course, they had to do this quietly. You know, on the one hand, they agreed with the government of Poland, represented here by the foreign minister of Poland, Józef Beck, that an agreement had to be reached and that Sapieha had to be humbled and made to eat crow, in a sense, but to do so in a way that would not publicly damage the office of the Archbishop of Krakow. So behind the scenes, you know, the government itself didn't want the anti-church rowdiness to get out of hand. They didn't want Parliament to take into its rough hands the sort of delicate construct of church-state relations. I mean, as I said, you know, for 20 years, this was an issue that was much more difficult to manage than a lot of people understood. So anyway, they came up with a deal. And what were the elements of that deal? Okay. The transfer of the body of Piłsudski into the Silver Bells Tower would stand. That was going to happen soon enough anyway. Now that it had happened, there was no point in reversing that. Sapieha was going to be made to apologize publicly to the President of Poland for the disrespect and high-handedness that he had shown. Sapieha was made to write a letter to President Moshchitsky. Moshchitsky took one look at it and said, this is no apology at all. And Sapieha was made to write a second one, you know, like a bad kindergartner or something like that. And the second copy was ultimately deemed to be acceptable. Lastly, the government got its way on the matter of principle, that from now on, custody over the Wawel graves, decisions about who is to be interred, who would make decisions regarding maintenance of the graves or the positioning of, that those would be jointly handled by the Archdiocese of Kraków and by the Polish government. Now, part of the reason that they came up with this deal very quickly was to try to salvage what could be salvaged from the looming train wreck of the impending visit of King Carol of Romania. Luckily, Sapieha was taken ill And in this case, it does seem to have been a real illness. He was suffering from pneumonia at the time. As a matter of fact, people in the Vatican, some of them wondered if, well, why has he done this? Well, maybe his brains are addled by his illness or something like that. But whether it was a real illness or a diplomatic illness, Sapieha did not directly receive King Carol. In his absence, it was the nuncio, Archbishop Cortesi, who met Carol and escorted him through his rounds. And here you see King Carol arriving at the Vavel, not entering the cathedral proper, and paying respects. You see here the separate entrance to the Silver Bells crypt, where he could pay respects at the grave of Piłsudski. Now, in the aftermath, even though the issue was settled, Piłsudski's bones had been moved, Sapieha had been humbled, King Carol's visit had been sort of arranged, the agreement between the Vatican and Poland for how to settle it had been reached, you still had an extraordinary session of Parliament called for the sole purpose of rehearsing the whole Vatican Vavel incident. The whole thing, you talk about it, and the whole thing kind of bears marks of almost the ridiculous, right? Things like a tempest in a teapot and all of that. But you would be astonished to read the transcripts of the parliamentary session and see how seriously people were taking this. It was described in tones as an enormous indignity, an unforgivable offense. People in Poland would never forget the insult given to Piłsudski by Archbishop Sapieha. Sure. It all blew over. All blew over a few months later. Things were more or less back to normal. There. Okay. Oh, no. We don't want that. There. Okay. And this was the location of the Piłsudski sarcophagus as of November 1937. A few months later, as you can see, no lines, no mass, decorum, all of that. And the whole controversy seemed to blow over. So if nothing happened, if nothing significant was changed by this incident, why is it important and why is it instructive? And the reason I think, and you'll be relieved to know that I'm about to conclude, is that governing the affairs of church and state in Poland, by reputation, one of the most Catholic of countries, it was widely believed that Poland and Catholicism were nearly synonymous, that the church in Poland was such a powerful force that it was inevitable that church and state would cooperate in almost complete harmony. And in fact, as I hope I've indicated, this was not the case. This was a different Poland. It was a Poland where not everybody was either Polish or Catholic. Not even all the Poles were Catholic in the same sense that they would be Catholic, but that this would have a political dimension. There were a fair number of Poles who, though they might consider themselves Catholics, were very suspicious of the role of Catholicism in public life. They didn't want the church to have too much say in public affairs, particularly among the educated elites, particularly among the circles who are active in politics, or the professions, or government. It used to be said in these days that the government of Poland, the elite of Poland, was less Catholic than the nation as a whole. So, in a country where, by tradition and history, Catholicism and patriotism and Polish national identity were closely entwined, but many people among the leaders of Polish society had qualms about the influence of the church in public life, maintaining peace between church and state was much more difficult than it appeared. And it depended in many ways on these kind of makeshift arrangements. As I've said, the almost personal friendship of Pius XI, who exerted his influence behind the scenes while all this was going on, to make sure that things were settled in such a way that would do honor to the memory of his Polish friend. Where did I begin this sentence? I've forgotten. But anyway, I can probably shorten this and say, it was a difficult trip, much more difficult than was apparent to many people. And the way it was done was, there was this sort of unsettled conflict among Poles as to exactly the role that Catholicism should play in national life. And it was almost like there was a tacit truce between the warring groups not to press that question too hard. This was, the Wawel incident was the one time when this sort of explosive mixture almost detonated, and the delicate balance between church and state, between Catholicism and those elements in Polish society that weren't sure about how much of a role Catholicism should play in public life, the Wawel incident was the one time where it came close to breaking down and actually leading to a crisis of church and state. But nowadays, in a sense, bringing it back home, Piłsudski for many years was the only resident of the Crypt of the Silver Bells under the tower of the Wawel Cathedral. But since 2010, he has been joined by the other couple dignitary that I mentioned before, Lech and Maria Kaczynski. Poland is Poland. It's an argumentative country. The controversies over the burial of the Kaczynskis in the Silver Bells crypt caught up Poland for many weeks in 2010. The controversy over the transfer of the mortal remains of the first Marshal of Poland, Marshal Piłsudski, in 1935 and 1937, has long been forgotten. But if we take a look at this curious incident, I think it can explain a good deal about just how complicated the interplay of God and Caesar, of church and state, was in Poland, even in the most Catholic of European countries. Thank you. Happy to take any questions, if any of you got them. Otherwise, yes?
I would have a question. In your opinion, Kaczynski should be buried?
Oh, boy. Next question, should Kaczynski be buried? I'm not sure there's a right answer. You can make a case for, you could make a case against. Not being Polish, I think I should, you know, I think that's a question more for Poles than for Americans. Among my Polish acquaintances, I think it's safe to say that the majority of them would not consider Kaczynski to be, quote unquote, worthy of interment in the Wawel. Still and all, one can understand the emotional reaction after the plane crash in Smolensk. Of course, as many of you will know, to this day, Polish politics remains highly charged, very partisan, and one of the most partisan issues is precisely how the presidency and the person of Lech Kaczynski should be remembered and more memorialized in more ways than simply whether he should be buried in Wawel or not, but the question of public monuments. Some of you may recall that there was a big dust-up over the location of a memorial cross erected outside the presidential palace, and should it be moved? Poland seems to get into things like this. One is reminded, for instance, of the crosses outside the Auschwitz camp to memorialize the visit of John Paul II, whether this was proper, whether it was a desecration of the memory of the Holocaust. I haven't answered your question directly. But that's probably the most honest answer I could give. Now, whether my Polish acquaintances would amount to a legitimate cross-section of Polish society, or whether that would reflect the fact that I tend to speak to, oh, this is going to sound so pompous, you know, academics who politically speaking would represent perhaps the opposition to Kaczynski rather than supporters, you know, that's also a possibility. I'll just leave it by saying that it's quite controversial and remains so to this day.
Would visiting his grave make any statement?
Kaczynski or Piłsudski? Piłsudski. No. Any sense of partisanship has been taken out of the equation. And of course, a lot of that has to do with the fact that 75 years have passed. To a certain extent, Piłsudski remains a figure of controversy in Polish culture, but in the atmosphere after communism, he is now generally seen as almost certainly the greatest political figure of the early 20th century, of early 20th century Poland, and now he would be regarded by most Poles as more a symbol of patriotism rather than of a particular party. So at this point, paying homage at Piłsudski—that's a very good question. Both of these questions have been very good. That's why I'm having so much difficulty answering them. It wouldn't have any taint of politics or partisanship or anything. It would now simply be a sort of paying of respects to Polish patriotism and Polish history.
Let me ask a question about your research method.
Yes.
I'd be very interested in hearing how an archbishop communicates with the government. What was the mechanism? Did he stand in line at the aircraft office?
It varied. Some of it was by letter. You know, some of it was by written correspondence. And a lot of the correspondence that I have from this particular incident was, in fact, in written form. And I ran across them. You know, Cardinal Sapieha has a voluminous set of papers in the archives of the Archdiocese of Kraków. And you can find copies of correspondence elsewhere. I've seen them in Polish state archives. I had the great good fortune of, you know, one good thing about taking too long to write a book is that sometimes things can come as a godsend. And for a long time, I thought, well, I'm going to have to publish this book without having access to the material in the Vatican archives, because it was closed to researchers after the year 1922. But a few years ago, Pope Benedict the 16th opened the archives for the period of the papacy of Pius the 11th. So I was able to go a few years ago and actually use the Vatican archives for that purpose. There was some communication by telephone. I don't have transcripts, but I know I've seen descriptions of these. And sometimes simply by personal meetings. But most of the evidence that I have used is actually in written form, whether it's actual documents or memoranda or whatever. Yes?
It's fascinating. But it seems to me that there were three parties here. Mm-hmm. There was the Vatican.
Yes.
There was the Catholic Church of Poland, that you would think, I mean, if I, in my life, then, that they would work together against the secular, but no. Because your introduction was illuminating in the sense that there were other factors that were playing there. So this is like three.
I'm so glad you brought that up. Because this is actually a major contention in my book. Actually, yes, this was a sort of tripartite, a trialogue, if you will. Public opinion didn't have anything to do with it, really. You had sort of three elite mechanisms working. You had the Polish government, you had the Vatican, and you had the hierarchy of the Polish Church. One would think that the Vatican and the Polish Church would more often than not be on the same page. They were not. That was one of the fascinating things about it. The Polish Church, by inclination, for the most part, politically, would have preferred the National Democrats. They would have been opposed to Piłsudski. However, it was Pius XI, the Pope, who trusted Piłsudski, preferred Piłsudski's policies, and despised the National Democrats. I could go into detail about exactly what it was about National Democrat approach that Pius didn't like. Personal factors had something to do with it. It was precisely the most prominent National Democratic bishops who were very suspicious of him as nuncio because of his close relations with Piłsudski, who sort of manufactured his expulsion from Poland under humiliating circumstances. Pius XI thought that the Polish Church, how to put this, that it acquired defects during the long period of foreign rule, that it had become intensely political. You know, one thing was that during the days before World War I, when there was no Poland, the Polish Church had sort of taken upon itself the idea of being the tribune of the Polish people. It had become intensely political and almost automatically disposed to opposition towards governmental authority. Now, what had been a useful virtue before independence now became very difficult in times of independence. Some of you may know that in France, in the 19th century, there was a long dispute inside France between Catholics who supported monarchy and anti-clericals who supported the Republic. This was an argument that envenomed French politics for years and years and years. And one pope, a very well-known pope of the 19th century, Leo XIII, even though the Catholic Church was not disposed to favor republics in those days, republics were thought of as being irreligious, anti-clerical, nevertheless, he imposed on the French church support for the government. You know, this is good for the church in the long run. You have to reconcile yourself to the civil authority. Now, why do I bring this up? Because I think that, in effect, what Pius XI did in Poland in the 1920s and 1930s was a Polish version of what the Vatican had enforced on the French church in the 19th century. Pius XI was convinced that what you had to do was to extricate the Polish church from politics. You know, go back into the churches. Yeah, you know, only oppose the government when you have to. Don't be irresponsible in your criticism. I'm going on too long, but you know, I'm taking grievous advantage of the opportunity that your question has offered me. But yes, this was a trialogue, if you will, and the lines weren't hard and fast. Sometimes, you know, the government would ally itself with the Polish bishops to frustrate something the Vatican might want done. More often than not, it was Piłsudski and Pius XI ganging up on the Polish bishops. It was a fascinating and very complex sort of interplay. It means that you have to, you know, unfortunately, to read the book, you have to go through a lot of slog of detail. It's precisely the detail where you find out how these things work. So you don't read the book. It's a good thing to do on spring break.